Welcome to Fielding Questions, a podcast produced in collaboration between Egg Country Farm Credit Services and the Red River Farm Network that explores the world of agriculture and rural life. Our guest today is well known for taking historical context and turning it into forecasting for the future. Let's welcome Sean Hackett to the program. Sean is the president of Hackett Financial Advisors Incorporated, and he joins us now. Welcome, Sean.
Thanks, Adam. Always appreciate the invitation to speak about our work, and I'm looking forward to the conversation.
Well, Sean, before we talk numbers, you take a very fascinating approach to forecasting what is to come within agriculture. You examine historical data for areas like the value of U.S. dollar, geopolitical trends, cost of capital, demographics, environmental factors, and the such. What led you to begin finding value in the past to help predict what is to come?
My training is in chemistry, scientist, and in science, we appreciate the concept of the repeatability of nature, of the natural forces that are operating in cells and in chemical equations and reactions and that sort of thing. And we also believe in the concept of the scientific theory of the idea that you have a hypothesis, you test the hypothesis with data, and then you look for statistically significant correlations and cyclical patterns that can help you derive scientific principles going forward, create new reactions or equations, or in the case of what we do, try to map out some of these important variables that impact ag prices and ag production to give our customers and those that are listening to us an idea of what has happened in the past. What kind of commonalities have we found, and where do we sit today in terms of those patterns? And if the history rhymes as it typically does, you know, what can we expect in the near term and also in the longer term? Because ag is a long-term business, and so we're able to kind of feed off of our scientific training with something that we really are passionate about, which is agriculture and agricultural producers and price forecasting, and trying to do a good job at providing some unique information that is probably not mainstream in terms of what you typically hear on an ongoing daily and weekly basis.
All right. So maybe before we get into what's to come, how about where do you see us right now? What are some of the factors that you think are happening right as we speak that's impacting our world today?
Well, I mean, certainly, really, since the trade war between the U.S. and China began when Trump was president, we've been seeing an escalation in geopolitical tensions, geopolitical skirmishes, and that has been driving prices up and down, meaning the volatility coming from a globalized world becoming more dysfunctionally deglobalized has caused all kinds of issues. Of course, COVID being an accelerator to that process. So that's clearly something that's going on now that has been impacting ag prices and production and trade flows. Another factor is we've been seeing unprecedented fiscal debts around the world in terms of governments borrowing more money than they're bringing in to a level that historically is pretty unusual, if not unprecedented, and how the world has been printing money to solve that problem is leading to a lot of gyrations in currencies and how different prices in different countries translate to other countries and prices, and the volatility in the currency markets that we're currently seeing and have been seeing is another big driver. And really the most important factor, especially for agriculture, is this dramatic increase in weather anomalies. That means weather that just seems really off the charts, unusual, unprecedented, one in 50 year, one in 100 year kind of anomalies, whether it's record cold, record hot, record rain, record snow. It just seems to be perpetuating around the world, and it's been causing a lot of production rogue waves, we've been calling it, that's also been adding to price volatility. So these three cyclical patterns are seen to be aligned, according to our work, for the first time in about 400 years. And it looks to us that these trends are going to actually accentuate or amplify going forward. And that means that price volatility is here to stay. And what that means for me and the message from price volatility means there's going to be a lot of opportunity for both producers and end users in the ag world to manage that risk for better economic advantage if you're proactive in doing things maybe a little differently than you would have done, you know, let's say 10 or 20 or 30 years ago when things were a little bit more more docile and calm.
Do you see any long-term impact on agriculture from inflation, the value of the U.S. dollar, or maybe the cost of capital?
Well, certainly where we are fiscally, meaning that the U.S., you know, running deficits on an annual basis like we've really almost never seen before, other than typically in wartime, it's bringing to question, and legitimately so, how much longer the U.S. dollar can remain the reserve currency, playing that role of the currency that everyone trusts to stash their money or their reserve capital. And the fact that we're seeing interest rates rising and that the interest expense of the U.S. budget as a percentage of revenue and as a percentage of the budget skyrocketing, you know, it's becoming more clear that there might be a need to rethink how the global financial system operates. It's not dissimilar to what occurred when England, who had the pound, which was the reserve currency, eventually lost that status to the U.S. dollar. It was a big shift in how markets acted, and there was a huge period of adjustment, which means substantial increase in inflation as the world got used to a new set of rules and a new way of managing capital flows in and out of different markets at different times. So we think this could be another one of those significant periods where we go through one of these monetary resets. And in the case of the U.S. and the U.S. dollar, a reset means people reducing their exposure to the U.S. dollar reserve currency system. And by definition, that means some kind of a U.S. dollar devaluation or loss of purchasing power, which would make prices that are priced in U.S. dollars, like corn prices in the U.S. or soybean prices or cattle prices, significantly reprice higher as the world reprices what that looks like. And so we think that there is a long history of a reason to suggest we could be seeing a very momentous currency-related inflation change, not necessarily because the supply and the demand are changing. It's simply because the prism with which you use to look at the price of corn in U.S. dollars is going to lose its value or its purchasing power.
I think the logical follow-up question to that is if the U.S. dollar were to lose some or more of its status worldwide, you know, what would really be out there to replace it? Would it be more of a series of different currencies that are in the mix as opposed to just one single currency?
From what I can see, the world is shying away from letting another country take the baton this time because, quite frankly, there's not a good history of any country holding on to a reserve currency for more than, let's say, 80 to 100 years. So it looks to me like there's an appetite for some kind of an amalgamation of different countries' currencies. The most popular current view is that there's these special drawing rights that actually trade, which is an amalgamation of your larger currencies of the larger countries that many think would be a better benchmark for taking away country risk and having it spread out over the more important countries economically. There's even a lot of talk that we could be looking at some kind of a digital reserve currency like Bitcoin, cryptocurrencies, where no country really owns or manages Bitcoin. It's sort of this global digital benchmark that obviously has taken off and gotten a lot of attention, a lot of controversy over digital currencies, whether they're real or not. But nonetheless, I think something that's more decentralized, less country specific is where we're going. And time will tell exactly what that looks like. But I kind of feel we're not going to a new single country currency. It's going to be an amalgamation so that we can have a better overall, fairly sustainable monetary system, I think.
And you did bring up foreign conflicts earlier. We've seen the Russia-Ukraine conflict playing out. But are there any other areas of the world that you would be particularly worried about if issues were to arise?
From a commodity standpoint, you know, I think that when you're looking at what's happening with where ag commodities are really sensitive. You know, I think, first of all, obviously, Russia, Ukraine is a sensitive area. China is a very sensitive area. And I also think the Middle East is a very sensitive area, because the Middle East is hopelessly short on food, and they have a substantial excess of energy. And what I worry about or think about is if this skirmish that we're seeing, or this altercation, this unfortunate situation that's going on between Israel and Gaza and the Houthis and all the different players involved, you know, should that spread more into a Middle Eastern wide conflict, and we start seeing refineries in Saudi Arabia coming offline and seeing huge swaths of energy coming offline. You know, energy is involved in everything in this world, including producing food, whether that's from drying down corn with natural gas or propane or using fertilizer. You know, everything is tied to the energy cycle. And so if I'm thinking about a hot button that could light off or set off, a new wave of dysfunction, I kind of feel the Middle East is the place to watch to see if what's going on with Israel and the surrounding areas is isolated as it so far has been, more isolated, meaning it's more of a horrendous humanitarian consequence, but it hasn't yet been a major consequence to disrupting supply of energy and commodities and food. But I just think some of the stuff we're seeing, what's happening with the Red Sea, you know, it's dangerous. It's very, very dangerous. And I think that, you know, that could easily, you know, mushroom into what happened with Russia, Ukraine, but on a much more impactful level in terms of what it could mean for long-term inflation and long-term issues for sustainability of supply of key food and energy commodities that the world relies on to maintain economic health and also to maintain the wealth and the health of the human societies that they operate.
Sean, thinking about demographics, there are a lot of countries, particularly in the developed world, with challenging demographics, one could say. What could this really mean for agriculture going forward, and what major changes do you foresee in this part of the equation?
Demographics, as long as we know what the numbers are, is a fairly exact science. I mean, babies are babies. Either they're born or they're not born. And if you haven't had them, you just really can't do anything to have more of them right away to change the demographics, unless you are going to allow for a massive immigration cycle, which comes with it a lot of complication, as we're experiencing here in the U.S. on an ongoing basis. What I see is the main driver for commodity and food demand over the last 20 to 25 years has really been Chinese demand growing every year. And that's been sort of a staple understanding that that's going to go on into perpetuity. Recently, however, the last several months, a lot of the worries over the Chinese economy, the Chinese collapsing real estate market, stock market, and some of the lack of demand we've seen from them is starting to make people worry that their extremely poor demographics stemming from the one-child policy that they had for a long time, that those are huge headwinds that are now starting to show up, meaning their population is now starting to shrink for the first time in modern day Chinese history. So that has huge long-term headwinds to it, because if Chinese demand flatlines or actually falls, then our whole agricultural system that's been geared towards growing yield and growing production year after year to meet this insatiable demand kind of falls apart. And my view, however, is that I think the Chinese situation will not be anywhere near as bad as many suspect. I think the onset of artificial intelligence, quantum computing, these exponentially efficiency-laden technologies, which China is embracing rapidly, offers the possibility that at least for the first decade, we could see productivity gains and the output, the wealth per remaining Chinese worker in their prime earning years compensate for a lack of actual people in those roles, meaning that one can offset the other. It doesn't mean a rip-roaring economy. It doesn't mean rip-roaring demand, but it means probably an economy that can muddle along and still provide some steady ongoing demand. Where we see the bigger opportunity for a big shift, however, is if we look at the only other country that has the population to really supplant or recover some of the lost demand from China, and that would be India. No one really knows for sure, you know, what the numbers exactly are, but let's just put it this way. It looks like both countries are fairly comparable in terms of total amount of people. The difference is, however, the India younger population that is ready to move into their 35 to 55 peak earnings years, where there's a significant high level of education, it's just getting started, meaning their demographics are about as good as you could possibly imagine to have a huge consumer demand boom over the next, let's say, 20 or 30 years. So we think there's a really good opportunity that what if China can muddle along and give us time for India to find its place in the consumer world, that we could actually see the demand for food, for commodities, continue to grow at a fairly decent clip. Although we might have a little bit of indigestion here in the next few years until that becomes, you know, more of a clear trend. I would say some of the things that are showing us we might actually be pretty close to this is that India in the last 18 months has put a ban on rice exports, put a ban on wheat exports, put a ban on sugar exports, put a ban on cotton exports, and has imported milk for the very first time in the country's history because prices domestically are so high because of strong demand and their inability to produce food, supplies of food domestically to meet that demand, says we might already have crossed this line where they're going to start becoming a larger and larger consumer and importer of these key food and energy commodities. And so if that's the case, I'm not so sure that the Armageddon view that many are having out there is going to turn out to be that way. We're pretty optimistic India can really shine and offer a bright spot for demand going forward that can keep this the current ag food chain going the way that it's been constructed.
So, Sean, what keeps you up at night? Are there any trends that are happening today that worry or concern you going forward?
The biggest concern for me is that, you know, we're in this escalating geopolitical cycle. It's a 53.5-year cycle. I don't know why that's the time frame, but it's been operating this way for hundreds of years. And what that essentially means is that every 53.5 years, we get into a world war that creates a lot of problems, not only humanitarian-wise, but also economically. And that 53.5-year cycle, by the way, peaks around 2026, plus or minus 1 year, if it's to repeat. And if we were to get into some kind of a world war where everyone is fighting each other and spending even more money and printing even more money, it's very unpredictable what it's exactly going to mean for everybody, other than it's probably going to be extremely unpleasant for most. It might be very, very good, by the way, for prices for commodities and for food commodities and ag commodities. All the history that we have done going back to the 1700s says every time we get into these escalating geopolitical cycles into a world war, we do see pretty wild inflation in hard assets and in food assets. So, you know, while it may be very, very unpleasant for the world, it actually might be fairly good for those that are involved in producing those assets. You know, not that I want to see, you know, U.S. farmers doing well at the expense of the world going into world war. But it's not up to me. It's not up to you. It's the way the world goes. But I worry about that because, you know, a lot of the freedoms and a lot of the things we have taken for granted in terms of how we interact with each other, the free flow of information, you know, I could foresee a time that the world gets very totalitarian where, you know, everything clamps down and we kind of move into more of a dark ages in terms of how we relate to each other and how we communicate with each other. And any time I've seen that happen in the past, it's just been a very difficult period for advancing human society. And so I just, you know, of course, now we have nuclear weapons that could create common outcome that's a little different than we might have seen in the past. And so I just worry that somehow, some way, somebody does something with nuclear weapons that sets off a chain reaction that sets the world on a really challenging dark path for a while. And so if I'm losing sleep, I'm definitely losing sleep over the prospect of that scenario playing out in the, in the years ahead.
All right. And what advice do you have for listeners who are trying to process our conversation here today? How can they prepare and ultimately capitalize on this information?
Well, I live here in South Florida. We're in the Hurricane Alley, or one of the Hurricane Alleys of the United States. And I always, try to take the view that I would rather have very good information that a particular season is going to be very active. And I want to have a good idea if a Category 5 or Category 6 is going to likely hit my area. Because if I have that information, if I'm aware of that information, while I may not be able to reduce every single risk that may come my way for something like that, there are many things I can do for myself, for my family, for my friends, for my neighbors, that can mitigate many of those risks by being proactive in managing those risks. And that's kind of how I feel when it comes to farming, agriculture, the ag industry. We're entering a period where unprecedented price volatility, economic volatility, currency volatility, geopolitical volatility, and climate volatility is in front of us. And then I think if you're embrace that instead of fearing it as a liability, it can become a huge asset. Just look what's happened in the last 4 or 5 years where we had $3 corn, $8 corn. Now we're looking at $4 corn. These are big moves that give both sides, whether you're the end user, the livestock producer to buy feed, or the producer to sell, there's a lot of wiggle room in here, significant economic changes in fortunes that one can take advantage of through the use of better technologies, use of better crop insurance selection, better seed selection, better hedging techniques and cash marketing strategies to be proactive against all of this. And so that instead of having these markets eat you up and be reactive to them, you can actually find your way through them in a more of a thriving fashion. And that's really the takeaway that we see, is that we don't think you can operate a farming business today going forward the way you or your grandfather did or his grandfather did. I think you have to be much more on the ball with being proactive and active in managing these volatility risks that are in front of us, so that you can see it through and actually be a prosperous as a family farm or as someone involved in the ag food chain.
And final question for you, where can people go to find out more information about you and the work that you do?
I guess there's a couple of places. Our website, of course, is Hackett, H-A-C-K-E-T-T, advisors.com. We do have some social media on Twitter, at Feridex. It's F as in Frank, E-R-I-D as a dog, E-X-11. We also have a LinkedIn page. We're not habitual posters of social media, but we do from time to time let people know some of the things we're thinking about, some of the cycles we're looking at, so they can have a better idea of how we look at things, where we see things, to see if what we're bringing to the table might be of value to those that are involved in your group, in your organization, listening to your podcast, or reading your wonderful magazine that you put out.
Sean, thank you very much for a very fascinating conversation today. We appreciate your time.
Thanks, Adam. Always appreciate this, and keep up your great work on the behalf of farming. It's always greatly appreciated by me.
That is Sean Hackett, president of Hackett Financial Advisors Incorporated. If you have a question about a financial topic, we would love to hear from you. You can message Ag Country on Facebook, tweet at them on Twitter, or submit your question using their website at agcountry.com.